And I hope it's a fruitful study for us. I kind of got to thinking about it. It's a book that I've been wanting to really tackle for a while. And then as Michael was leading us through the spiritual disciplines book, he kept mentioning, you know, he's on this journey with thinking about idolatry. And I thought, really, that is the, and somewhere I was reading, they're like, that is like the whole issue in the Bible. Everywhere you look, it's talking about people in idolatry and how they're supposed to be coming out of idolatry and the faithfulness to God. I mean, it's everywhere. And it's not just an Old Testament or a New Testament concept. Idolatry is something that, whether we acknowledge it or admit it or not, it's something that we deal with on a regular basis, if not a daily basis. And so it seemed like an appropriate topic for us to tackle. And this evening, eventually, I want to dive into a text of Scripture or a particular story that you're going to know, I think, pretty well. But it'll be interesting, I think, how we see the potential for idolatry in that story. let me start with this. The most popular part of the Declaration of Independence. Anybody like know any parts of the Declaration of Independence? Like, can you think of any quotable parts of that? How about the part where it says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident," right? How does that go? "That all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness," right? Now, it's interesting. I was thinking about that particular statement, and I get the life and the liberty part, but I've always had this little bit of a struggle with the pursuit of happiness. And I think maybe it's because of kind of the American context of what we think of when we talk about happiness. It's like my pleasure above all else. Like, you know, my pleasure is guaranteed in the Declaration of Independence, right? So don't do anything that might take that away from me. Back in the day, though, might have been a little bit different. We would probably incorporate some of these ideas into this pursuit of happiness, but the idea of pursuing happiness meant pursuing prosperity, thriving, and well-being, right? Prosperity, thriving, and well-being. So this is kind of the essence of life, isn't it? Or maybe not, right? But it's something that all of us, to some degree, we do pursue in life, right? And we do whatever it takes to achieve those things. At some level, and some people to greater degrees than others, right? Prosperity, thriving, and well-being. We put a lot of time, we put a lot of money, we put a lot of effort into those things because we value them. We value them very highly, and we'll almost do whatever it takes to achieve that. And I like what Tim Keller wrote. He says, "We never imagine," now think about this, "we never imagine that getting our heart's deepest desires might be the worst thing that can ever happen." You thinking about that? Getting our heart's deepest desires might be the worst thing that can ever happen to us. Now, why would getting my heart's deepest desire potentially be a disaster in my life? It's right there, right? It depends on what my heart's deepest desire is, right? Now, this isn't an absolute statement, because if my deepest desire is for Christ and His glory above all else, I'm not going to run into any kind of disastrous life situation or spiritual condition. But if my deepest heart desire is for something else, and there are in an infinite number of other things we could put in that blank, man, if I'm in headlong pursuit of that thing, it could potentially be disaster, right? It's only if that desire is for God Himself. Now, what's the, you say there's a good likelihood that greatest desire in our heart is going to be sin. When you think about Romans 1, do you have like good thoughts or bad thoughts about what's going on in Romans 1? Probably not good thoughts, right? And Romans 1 tells us that the tendency of the human heart is to seek God or seek idols. To seek to worship something in creation or to worship the Creator. Something in creation, right? That is the natural tendency of the human heart. And so in chapter 1, verse 24, we're told, therefore, now think about this, therefore God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts, or the desires of their hearts, right? God gave them up. Now, why could getting our heart's deepest desire often be a disaster? Because there's a point when potentially God says, you want it, you can have it. Now, if we're a little kid and mom says, all right, I give in, you can have it, we're celebrating, we're having a good time, right? But when God says, you want it, you can have it, that's disaster, right? We may think it's good and fun and enjoyable for a little while, but that pleasure is not really pleasure. It's just the whitewashing of death. So, in chapter 1 in Romans, God let them have what they truly desired. Now, what did this look like? Well, we're told it looked like worshiping something in creation rather than the Creator. Whether they realized that what they were worshiping, whether they realized they were worshiping at all, right? They had put God aside, and if you've ever heard this statement, I think it's one of the biggest lies. I don't think we do it intentionally, but one of the biggest lies that we tell is we have this God-shaped hole in our heart that's just empty and void until God fills it. No, it's not. No, it's not. It's filled with something, I promise you. It may not be God. In Romans 1, that hole in their heart is not filled by God, but it's filled by something. It's filled by worship of something, whether they realize it or not. And God just gives them over to that, right? And so here's the point. If creation or anything in creation, which I guess is creation, right? That was a little bit redundant, but you know what I mean, right? If creation is the source of our hope and our happiness, we'll end up heartbroken in the end, right? So let me just say all of that kind of to get us started. Now, I want us to look deeper into the story, probably a well-known story to you, the story of Abraham, all right? The story of Abraham, we'll take a close look at it tonight. When you think about Abraham and Sarah, or Abram and Sarai, as they were known early on, when you think about what was probably the greatest desire of their heart, what was it? A child. Now, why would you say that? What do we know about Abraham and Sarah? They couldn't have any kids, okay? So we've got the unfortunate Hagar incident, right? Yeah? The unfortunate Hagar incident that caused all kinds of disaster, right? But I mean, they're already like, you know, 26 and 27 years old, right? Abraham and Sarah? Oh, no. No? Way older than that? Anybody remember how old they were? At what point? Look, you're getting technical here. When God made the promise. Yeah, Abraham was over 100. Sarah was over 90 years old. What's the likelihood that a child is in their future? Not real good, right? Not real good. But that was the desire of their heart. Now why? Well, we see that even today when you see barrenness. I mean, there's a heartbrokenness that comes with that. In Abraham's time, though, you see an even deeper-seated heartbrokenness because of the stigma, the family situation, you know, that firstborn child, that firstborn son was everything, right? We'll see more of that as we move along, right? Now, let me ask you this. When you think about that, and if we admit that the greatest desire of Abraham and Sarah Before God makes this promise, before he makes a covenant with them, their greatest desire is to have a child. Is that good or bad? Miss Carolyn says it's good. Jeannie's like, it's not bad. Where does it rank? So, but just in general, it's not bad, is it, right? We'll just go with that. In general, it's not bad, all right? So, after all, there was an expectation here, because think about it. When God sent Abraham, right, from his homeland, and he sent him to what was to be the promised land, and he gave him this promise in Genesis 12, verse 7, he says, to your offspring I will give this land. What? I don't have any. Sorry? Yeah, you got to have offspring before your offspring can take the land, right? So the big question in all of this is, did Abraham trust God alone? Did he desire God above all else? Or did he desire what he could get from God? A child or whatever else? You know, in our hearts, whatever else, right? Do we desire God above all else? Or is it what we can get from God? And of course, you know, you have to ask that question, because we do have the unfortunate Hagar incident, right? And Abraham's like, God, you know, you're toying with me here, right? You make it seem like you're going to give me this, and then you don't. And you know, the time span between God makes a promise and Isaac is actually born. Anybody remember how long that was? 25 years, right? Dad, you were close. 25, long time, all right? 25 years. And you know, I mean, after a few years, it's like, all right, maybe we need to take things in our own hands. I'm kind of that way. I'm like, God, I'll give you an assist. You know, I'll jump in there and help you. Hopefully I never do anything quite that crazy, but he just, you know, anyway, Sarah was involved, right? It was her idea. Hey, take Hagar, right? And Abraham's the man. He's like, sounds good. All right, let's do it. So that's what they do, right? All these years later, Isaac finally comes, but listen, that's not the end of the story, is it? Not the end of the story with Isaac, and not the end of the story with Abraham. Genesis 22, verse 2. This is where the story takes a bit of a twist, right? Genesis 22, verse 2. God says to Abraham, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, by the way, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. Why did God say this to Abraham? This seems crazy. Why did God say this to Abraham? Absolutely. It's a test, right? He wanted him to understand his priorities. Does God already know Abraham's heart? There's no information. Later on, he's going to say, oh, now I know that you fear me. But God's not learning new information. That's not the way it works. But Abraham needs to learn some new information, right? So we've got a little bit of a twist in the story here. Now, notice what God says to him, because this is really important. He says, take your son. Now, he could have just left it at that. Hey, take your son and go up to the mountain, which I'm going to tell you, and offer him there as a burnt offering. But he says, take your son. No. Take your only son. No. Take your only son whom you love, right? And he's just piling these words on top of one another. And he tells him to take him and offer him as a burnt offering. Now, God never said, Abraham, don't love your son. So keep that in mind. He never says that. Abraham simply can't make an idol out of his son, though. He can't make an idol out of Isaac. And at this point in the story, maybe we're thinking, well, was that really an issue? Was that a possibility? Did Isaac really become an idol? And how could that even happen? But the reality is, this is potentially what is going on. So, how do we know when we've made an idol out of our children or out of anything, really, because you could substitute Isaac for whatever it is in our lives. How do we know when we've made an idol out of something? Or ourself, or anything? What does that look like when I've made an idol out of it? Do I have to, like, set it up on the God shelf in my house? I saw that a lot when I lived in China. Every home you go in, you're like, oh, cool, you got the little God up there on the shelf, right? Is that what it has to look like? What does it look like? But I could tell you I don't value it more than I do Christ. By your actions? Yeah. Do you remember last week we talked about this? If there's something in your life other than God that you would say absolutely cannot live without, I can't go on any longer. It's ruined my life. That's become an idol, right? How else do we know? What does it look like when we've made an idol out of something? Yeah. So I should talk to my wife about coffee. Yeah. No, that's a good point. You know, what do you think about when you wake up in the morning? What is it that kind of consumes your thoughts? It could be a career. It could be family. It could be myself, making sure I look good. Easier to pick out somebody else's problems. Absolutely. Yeah. We get blinded to them, don't we? So when something in our life becomes more important than God, I'm spending... There you go. Those are all the words I was getting ready to say. That's it. Yeah, I mean, it becomes an idol in our life. So here's the deal. God's command to sacrifice an only child, that would be crushing, right? I mean, if God said that to me, I'd be like, seriously? I mean, clearly I'm hearing voices. That it's not what's going on. That would be crushing for any of us. But again, in Abraham's case, it's not like it would have been easy. It would have been crushing for him. Listen to what Tim Keller says there in the book. He says, all the hopes and dreams of a man and his family rested in the firstborn son. The call to give up the firstborn son would be analogous to a surgeon giving up the use of his hands, or of a visual artist losing the use of her eyes. Now, why would he make this statement? Why would he make this connection? Let's journey for a moment to the book of Exodus, right? The next book over from Genesis. In Exodus 22, verses 29 through 30, listen to what God says. Now, this is very shortly after Israel has come out of Egypt, right? Out of 400 years of slavery. And Moses has been up on Mount Sinai. He's brought the law down, and now there's more law being given. Exodus 22, 29 through 30 says this: "You shall not delay to offer from the fullness of your harvest and from the outflow of your presses. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. You shall do the same with your oxen and with your sheep. 7 days it shall be with its mother. On the eighth day you shall give it to me." Now, when God says, "You shall give it to me," what is implied here? What does he expect? You know what it means. It's not a trick question. What normally happens to animals that are given to God? Yeah, they're given in a sacrifice, right? Now, notice it's not just animals here, but we do talk about animals. You've got the firstborn of clean animals. They were to be offered as a sacrifice to God, right? Now, the firstborn of everything, right? The firstborn son, the firstborn male of anything was to be given to God. Now, what about the firstborn of unclean animals? Were they sacrificed to God? No. What about the firstborn sons of people? Were they sacrificed to God? So what was the expectation? Anybody know? What do you do about that? You give them to God's service? There's still that expectation in the text. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. All right, we'll go on to skip a couple chapters. Exodus 34, well, several chapters. Verse 20. Here's what God says. The firstborn, and a donkey, by the way, is an unclean animal. The firstborn of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb. Or if you will not redeem it, you shall break its neck. All the firstborn of your sons you shall redeem, and none shall appear before me empty-handed. There's got to be redemption that takes place. There has to be a substitution that takes place for unclean animals, or you break their neck. But with a child, you don't break their neck, right? We don't do that, right? But there has to be a redeeming that takes place. The firstborn belongs to God, all of them, right? Sin is the reason, right? But all of the firstborns belong to God. So when God judged Egypt, he brought plague after plague after plague, but when he really, really wanted to end the matter, what did he do? Y'all know it. What is it? He took the firstborn sons, didn't he? That was the end of the matter. He says, I'm God. Your firstborn belongs to me, and I'm here to claim it. And that's what he did. Unless what happened, unless there was redemption that took place, unless there was lamb's blood over the doorpost, even for the children of Israel, that was the case, right? So when God told Abraham, take your son, offer him as a burnt offering, Abraham suspects God's calling in his debt. God's calling in Abraham's debt, right? Isaac would die for the family's sins. Now, the only question that remains then is, will Abraham obey God or will he hold on to Isaac? Right? That is the big question. Will he obey God or will he hold on to an idol? There is no other alternative in this matter, right? So what would it mean then if Abraham says no? I'm not going to go to Mount Moriah. I'm not going to take Isaac. I'm not going to offer him up as a burnt offering. What does that mean? It means he's disobeying. Yeah. It means Abraham has an idol in his life, right? God might have just taken him right there on the spot. He's like, Mount Moriah here makes no difference. I'll take you both, right? I don't know. But what it definitely means is there's idolatry. If there's anything in our life that we look at and then we look to God and we're like, I choose this right now. That's become an idol, right? Or if we look to God and we know he's commanded us to do something and we say, no, because I've got this, that has become an idol in our life. Right? Well, we're going to finish this story with Abraham next week. We're not going to get rid of or finish it tonight, but we'll also make some more practical application with it next week. But I wanted to set it up tonight. But let me go ahead and ask a few questions as we kind of apply what we've already seen. Let me ask an easy softball question for us. What do we have, whether it be a child or a possession or a bank account or a job or anything, what do we have that doesn't belong to God? Nothing. We have nothing that doesn't ultimately belong to God. All right? So what would our response be then if God called us to give up something that we have in our lives, right? That we have. Or he takes it away. Would it paralyze us? Would life be over for us? If so, of course, then we've wandered into the field of idolatry. Now, think about the context here, and we'll just kind of elaborate on what we've already been talking about. What are some reasons God might take something away from you that you love dearly? Would he do that? Yeah. If it's not good for you? It could be a good thing, by the way, that's not good for you. Does that make sense? It could be a good thing that's not good for you. I think we talked last week, most of the idols, right? The vast majority of the idols in our lives are good things. They've just become too much in our lives, right? So what else would we say? What are some other reasons God might take away something we love dearly? Okay? He wants us to recognize what it has become in our lives. You think of any other reasons? Okay. So we see he's the one in control, right? It does no good ultimately to come to God tight-fisted and say, "Oh, not this." Because God can pry those fingers open, no problem. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, don't use those absolute statements with God. "I'll never do that," right? Yeah. Well, I want us to remember it's usually the good things in life that become idols in our lives. And so we have to be so careful, because it's easy to go about our daily life and somebody says, "Well, man, that's become an idol in your life." And you're like, "No, this is a good thing." "No, this is a good thing." You're like, "That's not the point. It's usually the good things." I bet if we were if we could look into each other's souls here this evening and make a list of all the potential idols or all the very real idols in our lives, in our hearts, few of them would be in the "no, that's just evil" category, right? Most of it would be in the "no, these are good things." We've let them become too much in our lives, right? And so sometimes God takes something away that we love dearly in order to reveal that or to remove that idolatry. Now, why might that be important for God to do, even if it's painful? Okay, so it's necessary for our sanctification. Yeah, why else? Yeah, so, yeah, and sometimes it's a very painful process of God removing things from our lives. And we can either go pout in a corner and say, "God is mean, God hates me," or we can say, "I know from experience and from God's word that he only does what is good for his children. This must be for my good." Right? Must be. And I may not always know the reason. I'm not saying everything God takes away is because it's become an idol in your life. But that is one reason why that might happen. Right? Sometimes he just needs us to know that we're dependent upon his grace and mercy, you know, daily. And so he allows things to come into our lives to teach us those lessons that we couldn't learn any other way. It's important that God reveal or remove those idols from our lives, because idols keep us from God. Idols aren't cute little trinkets that we keep on a wall. Idols aren't just little hiccups and hang-ups in our lives. Idols keep us from God. And so it is a serious matter. Next week, we'll talk about this, how it plays out. Abraham, you know, is going to have to figure some things out, right? He knows some things about God. He knows God is holy. He knows God is gracious. Now, how are these two things going to work together? And we'll finish that story and make more specific application. Any final thoughts, questions, complaints?